Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another edition of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding themselves, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding, and I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have a very special guest. His name is John Natashak, and John was the winner of the 1984 NPC Mr. Universe contest in the middleweight class. He also won his class at the 1984 NPC Nationals that year. And he had a really great physique. John had really great abs. He was always known for his incredible ab development, but also a very symmetrical physique. And he went on to compete in the pros for a couple of years after that. And he actually even came back into the Masters Olympia about 20 years later. So we're going to talk to John about his career. And John is now an IFBB judge. He is originally from New Jersey, but he has moved out to Florida for the last several years. And now John judges NPC shows and IFBB shows. So we also got into a discussion about the same discussion we had with Lonnie Tieper and Peter McGuff a couple of weeks ago about how the physiques have changed and if the judges are rewarding more symmetrical physiques. So that was a pretty interesting discussion. And then after our interview with John, we are going to have another article. And this one fits in with our interview last week with Leon Brown, because it is the original Sports Illustrated article that Leon was featured pretty prominently in. And it was the 1972 issue of Sports Illustrated. And this was the first article that Charles Gaines wrote about bodybuilding. And it was in 1972. It was the contest that Ed Eubenville put on in Holyoke, Massachusetts. And Leon Brown was the winner of that contest. And actually, a couple of the pictures from that article are also featured in the book Pumping Iron, which came out 2 years later in 1974. So it was this article that Charles wrote for Sports Illustrated that gave him and George Butler the idea to do the book Pumping Iron. So it's going to be a really good article. I never actually read it before, but a couple of our listeners sent me the article. So I'm going to read those emails in a second. So I appreciate those guys sending me the article, and we're going to read that as soon as our interview with John Natashak is finished. All right, and off the bat, I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, which is called Vintage Burn. It is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner. Or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion. And they also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute, bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, and the real deal Chris Cormier. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go to oldschoollabs.com, and you will get 12% off your order. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and what else is going on, guys? It is tax season. It is now April 15th, if you can believe it or not. So we've got to pay your taxes if you haven't paid them yet. So that's always an interesting time of the year. And also the other big news is Game of Thrones is on. It was on Sunday, so you're probably listening to this show on Monday. And this is the last season, season number 8. And the show has been going, I think, since 2011. It's a huge show, probably the most popular thing on TV right now. And I think there's only going to be like 8 episodes for this last season. I think a couple of the episodes are going to be like an hour and a half or even maybe even 2 hours. So that should be interesting. I have watched the season since it started. Aaron Singerman actually told me about it. And he told me to watch it. So, Aaron was a big reader of the books. So I started reading all the books after Aaron suggested it. So it's interesting how they've done the show, because they sort of followed the books pretty faithfully for the first 3 or 4 seasons. And then I think after season 5 or 6, I think it's been the last 2 seasons, going on 3 seasons, where the books pretty much ended, and then they had to create their own storylines. So if you're a reader of the books, you can actually really tell the difference between how the stories were before and how they are now. Just a kind of a different format. They're moving a little bit faster now, sort of maybe pleasing the audience a little bit, but it should be interesting where they go with it. And I just watched the first episode tonight, so it was pretty good. It's good to watch that show again. A lot of great characters, but really an awesome show. One of the best shows that was ever been on TV. So I did get some pretty good feedback from the Leon Brown interview we did last week. I'll read some of the comments that I got on Facebook. Cliff Kuhn said that was a very cool interview. Richard Baldwin said, John, another great interview of one of the greatest bodybuilders of the golden age. I met Leon on the set of Pumping Iron, and I love the guy immediately. He's maybe the nicest man I ever met and so funny. I could listen to Leon for hours. The incident he mentioned about Lee Priest went this way. I talked Leon into asking Lee why the hell he got that tattoo on his face, knowing a tough guy from New York like Leon would do it. I had my camera ready just in case Lee swung at Leon, but like Leon said, Lee just replied, I don't know. I've got another great story about Leon, the tough New Yorker who takes no crap from anyone, and he's one of the nicest guys I've ever met. Pat Comer, loyal listener to the show, said, great show. Your choice of articles at the end keep getting better. And Pat was one of the guys that sent me the Sports Illustrated article from 1972. So thank you, Pat. Dan Dillon, the mayor of bodybuilding, said Leon is such a great guy. Him and his wife are the best. The mayor of bodybuilding and Rob Tingo see him a lot at the New York shows. Tom Terwilliger said, I love Leon. I competed with him in the Junior USA back in the 80s. He was past his prime, and he still won the middleweight class. I was just coming up, and I won the light heavyweights. Leon took the overall. He is the humblest guy I've ever met. Sean Stone said, superb interview of a bodybuilder that deserves more recognition, but someone I've never even heard of before, despite reading Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, which clearly mentions Leon as being the first bodybuilder to ever be featured in Sports Illustrated. John, it's a massive credit to you that you are keeping these names alive and indelibly preserving our iron history. It was such a good interview, and you have a great way of getting your subjects to open up. Your reading of the article about the documentary Pumping Iron makes me wonder why all those 100 hours of unseen footage haven't been edited down or harvested for the untold wealth of memories that it must contain of the golden era. All of Zane's unseen footage would still be in there. How many more Arnold hijinks have we missed because that footage is rotting away in some vault? Why has no one tried to procure it? If they slapped it raw and unedited on a bunch of DVDs, I would pay big money just for a chance to see it once. Truly a tragedy if these great memories are lost to time. Keep up the great work, John, in doing your part to recreate and educate the masses about our once golden era. Yeah, Sean, I absolutely agree with you about that footage of Pumping Iron. What a shame that we haven't seen more of it. I believe Arnold owns all that footage because he bought it from George Butler probably 20 years ago or so. And I can't believe Arnold hasn't done anything with it either. With all the opportunities that we could do with the DVDs or make a special of it, or man, what a waste. So hopefully Arnold will do something about it. And nobody really talks about that either. So hopefully something will be done soon before it's too late. I guess from when I interviewed Charles Gaines, he said George Butler really wasn't doing that well. I guess he's got Parkinson's disease. But I think Arnold got that footage because there may have been some things on there he didn't want people to see. And this is when he was running for governor. So that had to be early 2000s. And so he's probably had that footage now for like 20 years, like I said. But I'm sure we could still. There's got to be some great, great footage in there. Just the training alone would be awesome to see. So hopefully something will be done one of these days. Artie Lampella, another great listener to the show, says, John, you should have asked Leon about the trip to Panama with Dennis Tenorino in the middle of a revolution. I remember him always so quiet with a big smile. As Dennis would say, he is a brother. And Dave Mastarakis said, tell Leon an old friend says hi. We would go against each other in several national contests. Thanks. All right. That's great replies from some great listeners of the show, all champions. So thank you guys for listening and making comments on the show. I also got an email from Pat Comer, and he included that article from Sports Illustrated. It said, hey, John, the Leon Brown interview was a masterpiece. You asked the question, what was Santa Monica like back then? In the article, The Men and the Myth, the book The Holy Barbarians by Lawrence Lipton was mentioned, and that book gives an excellent description of what Santa Monica was like back then. I hope this attachment of the Sports Illustrated article helps you It was Charles Gaines' first article on bodybuilding for Sports Illustrated magazine, the article that started the idea for Pumping Iron. And Mario Strong, who set me up with that interview with Leon Brown, said, "Hi, John, I just want to let you know I enjoyed listening to the interview we did with Leon Brown. As well as I know Leon, I even learned a couple things about him. Great interview. I will forward a link to the interview to some friends." And then he says, "Did you ever consider a Women of Bodybuilding series? I think this is something the Iron Agers would enjoy. Champions such as Rachel McLish, Carla Dunlap, Corey Everson, Linda Murray, Bev Francis have some great stories, including the making of Pumping Iron 2. And then Mario also sent me that article about Sports Illustrated, which we will read as soon as the John Natoshak interview is over. He says, "I'm looking forward to more great interviews. Thanks, Mario." Yeah, that's a great idea about the Women of Bodybuilding, and I have thought about that. So I just need to contact all those ladies and put all those interviews together. I know Rachel is on Facebook, and sometimes I do talk to her, not personally, but I think sometimes I mention some of her comments or stories, and she responds, so she might be open to it. Corey Everson, maybe also. Linda Murray, I do know. And Bev Francis, I'm sure I could get a hold of her. Carla Dunlap, I'm not sure how to get a hold of her, though, because I don't see her on social media, so I'm sure somebody would know. So I will just have to ask around. And hopefully that will come to bear, because I think that is a great idea for to give some of those women, especially when women's bodybuilding first started, give them some of their due. All right. I hope this podcast is sounding better. Also, I got a router that I needed, and we were dropping out some of the conversation we had before, especially the intros I was doing was dropping out. So I just got a new router. So hopefully that will work. All right. Before we get to our interview with John Natoshak, I'd also want to mention that we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. Do you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential? Then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida. It is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com, and tell them that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your order. And just also heard they are now in Texas as well. So if you live in Texas, make sure you call their number over here at 813-922-8939, or just go to FloridaAlternativeMeds.com, FLAlternativeMeds.com, and I'm sure they'll give you that information as well. And they also have a new product called the Magic Pill. It is developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So a month's supply of this amazing fat loss pill and thermogenic is $39.99. So just call Florida Alternative Medicine today at 813-922-8939, and you can order your own bottle of the Magic Pill. All right, here is our interview with John Natoshak, 1984 IFBB Mr. Universe. Hope you enjoy it. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And my special guest this week is John Natoshak. And John was the 1984 middleweight nationals and Mr. Universe winner that year. And then he competed as a professional, competing in the Mr. Olympia and many other pro shows. So, John, welcome to the show, buddy.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, John, we always start with our guests talking about the beginning. So the first time I heard of you was when you won that Nationals, and that was a pretty cool contest because it was covered on TV, the Mr. Universe was, and Chris Dickerson interviewed you. So how did you get started in bodybuilding? I know you're from New Jersey, and you were a police officer out there. What age were you when you started actually training?
I started messing around with weights when I was 23.
Later. Huh?
Yeah, I didn't get started early. It was actually a kind of a comedy act. The way it started, I was a disc jockey in some nightclubs locally.
Oh, really?
And, okay. All my buddies, my neighborhood buddies, were dancers, and they would compete.
Oh, okay.
Okay, back when there was something called the hustle.
Yeah, the 70s and the 80s, right.
Yeah, I'm dating myself. So
I remember that, too.
They would compete in these local shows, and they were winning all kinds of dance contests. And then they decided, well, we're going to step it up and go to the, what they, I guess, at that time were called regionals.
Mm-hmm.
And they got spanked, and they came back with their heads hanging low, and they were like, man, we got to start working out, lifting weights, because these guys are lifting these girls and throwing them up in the air and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
How about we start lifting weights? You want to work out with us? And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And believe it or not, we started in a basement in a house.
Mm-hmm.
With an old weeder set of barbells and dumbbells and one bench.
Wow.
And that was the beginning for me. That year, I guess that old phrase, I got bit by the iron bug.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started reading Muscle and Fitness and Iron Man and whatever what was available. And I started reading about protein and this and that. I found a little tiny health food store when there were none.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I asked about protein, and the kid that came out from behind the counter was like this big guy. And I'm like, wow, where do you work out? He told me, and that was pretty much the beginning, man. That was how it started.
What was your physique like before you started working out, John?
I was about 130 pounds, skinny kid, but, you know, somewhat muscular, mm-hmm. I guess you would consider. I wasn't large by any means. And I guess my body just reacted. I put on 26 pounds the first year I trained.
Wow. Holy cow. Yeah, you had the good genetics.
And truly not knowing, not having a clue as to what I was doing. I was just mm-hmm. kind of winging it like everybody else when they start, right?
Yeah, right, right. Did you make better progress than your friends when you guys were training in the basement?
Absolutely, yeah. I started to grow. I mean, they continued. They didn't give up, but they just didn't they didn't respond the way my body did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they never gave up. They continue even to this day. The couple that I'm still in touch with still work out.
Mm-hmm. What got you interested in competing then? Was there anybody that inspired you or anything?
You know, I used to look at the magazines and be like, mm-hmm. wow, look at these guys. No one really in particular, because every one of those guys to me at that time were phenomenal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I would sit in the house and look at these magazines and be like, gee, look at these guys. That's incredible. And then like 2 years later, you know, I'm on a plane flying out to Santa Monica for Joe Weider. It was crazy.
Wow. Like 2 years later.
Yeah. You know, it never came to where it was like, I'm going to compete. I'm going to be a pro or any of that stuff. Like these days, these guys don't even compete in the show and they want to be a pro, you know?
Yeah, I mean? Right off the bat. Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times as a judge people come up to me and say those things. And I'm like, well, maybe, you know, what show have you done? And they're like, well, I haven't competed yet. And I'm like, maybe you should try, see how you do before you start using that word pro.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I never even imagined in my wildest dreams that, that was going to happen. So really what kind of took off was there was a little local gym that opened called Billy's Bodybuilding. And it was in Bayonne, New Jersey, where I lived. And of course I joined.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a quote unquote coach trainer guy that was involved at that time. And he said, man, you look pretty good. You should compete. And I'm like, compete? What is that? You know? And I entered my first show and not knowing again what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I won the overall. And before that all happened, one of the judges came up to me and they're like, where are you from? Like, where did you come from? And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, you look unbelievable. What are you doing here? And I'm like, what do you mean? What am I doing here? He's like, you should be competing in the nationals. And
wow.
He's like, I hope you have a big car, because you're going to be bringing home a lot of trophies. So I was like, wow.
Shit. What a beginning.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. Pretty quick, too. I mean,
so what did your physique look like, John? I mean, was it pretty balanced once you started? Everything grew pretty balanced all over?
Yeah, I never really had. I mean, if I were to pick myself apart back then, my pecs were, you know, on the weaker side.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't massive, but I was very balanced and symmetrical. And, you know, I've always had good abs and good.
Yeah, those abs.
I mean, my dad looked like me, never lifting a weight in his life.
You know? Oh, really? Just, okay. Mm-hmm.
Through the training, obviously, that all expanded, you know. So that's really what it was, you know. I haven't trained calves in like 30 years, and people still talk about my calves when they see them in the gym and whatever, you know. So
when you look at a symmetrical physique, you look at the shoulders, the waist, and the calves, right? And you had all those body parts pretty much, right?
Yep, pretty much. They all responded well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what carried me through my competitive days was my balance and proportion. Certainly wasn't massive size, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what we had back then, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's where the physiques were judged. Now, when did you become a police officer, John?
I first went on the job in 1983.
Okay.
And I won the Nationals in 1984. Ironically, the Nationals was only my fifth contest in my life. And the Universe, when there was a Mr. Universe, was my sixth show.
Wow, unbelievable. What a rise.
Yeah, man, it happened so fast. And then, like I said, I never even imagined myself competing, let alone, you know, winning anything like that. And then at the at Mr. Universe, I find myself on stage. And Joe Weider whispering in my ear, I want you to fly out to California to do some photo shoots. And I'm like, what? Huh? You know?
Yeah.
And then the next thing, I'd never even flown on a plane. It might have been my second flight.
Uh-huh.
I'm sitting there all by myself flying out to Santa Monica, you know? California. It was pretty crazy, insane ride, man.
So what was your first big win, John? Was it that East Coast Championship in 83?
That was the second. My first was Mr. New Jersey.
Oh, really? Mr. New Jersey. Okay.
Yeah. East Coast was my second. Eastern America was my third.
Uh-huh.
Then I went to a USA show. Never traveled again. And mm-hmm. I went there with no food, no prep, no nothing. I get there and I had nothing to eat. And I came in fourth in that show. And but
yeah,
I met
I
a,
like
another.
I don't like 25 guys too, right?
Oh, that was a bunch. Yeah, that's when bodybuilding was huge, you know.
Yeah,
that's all we
had,
right?
Right.
And I came home with my tail between my legs. But at that show, I met a photographer / trainer, who you know. Latched on and said, man, you have potential. And I started listening to him. And next thing I know, I'm on stage at the Nationals, the NPC Nationals, and getting called out and being compared with John Araneta. And I won. Shockingly, I won, you know.
Who was that? Was that Bob Gruskin?
That was.
Yeah. Famous Bob Gruskin. Yeah. He's helped out a lot of people. So what did Bob do with your, did he change your training and diet? I mean, he obviously saw your potential.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously dialed me in. He changed my food, my diet. I mean, before that, I basically, for show prep, I lived on egg whites, tuna fish, and bananas. That was it.
Yeah. So, starving yourself.
Yeah, man, I literally starved. But it worked enough to win those local shows and regional shows.
It's funny you mention that, because I talked to Rich Gaspari, another New Jersey guy, and he said he met Gruskin, I think, when he was a teenager, and Gruskin did the same thing for him. He said, man, you're starving yourself. You got to eat more, and he increased his carbs and everything, and then Rich really got better for the next show, which was the Teen Nationals, or one of those top national level teenage shows, and I think he won it, you know, after listening to Bob.
Yeah, Rich shot up pretty quick too, you know.
Yeah.
I think he did a few more shows than I did to get to, you know, World Championships and the Nationals. But mine was, you know, my shows were very minimal.
So let's talk about that Nationals, John. Obviously, this was the biggest show in the country, and you had to, back then, this was only, I think, the third Nationals they had. You had to win your class at the Nationals, and then you had to go to the Universe, and you had to win your class at the Universe, and if you didn't, you couldn't turn pro.
Correct. There was no, you know, second, third place for cards.
Yes,
you won the Nationals. You had to go to the Universe or, you know, World Championships and win that in order to sign pro. And that happened. Funny story. You know, I was not, again, it was my sixth contest. I was overwhelmed. There were 56 guys in the class that year at the Universe.
And, wow. Unbelievable.
You know, Jim Mannion was our team captain and team coach, of course. And and I was out there on the stage and, of course, got, you know, called out front and center. And, you know, and I was still, like, in disbelief. And I'm like, did I win? And he's like, John, you could have fallen off the stage, broken a leg, and you still would have won. So, yeah, I got unanimous ones.
In the Universe. Unbelievable. Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
And what about the Nationals? Because you beat John Araneta, who was a nationally famous guy, a protege of Rory Liedemeyer, and he was well-known for many years. So he had a great physique.
He did, and he was bigger than I was, and it came down to he and I. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting into this thing, this John was, you know, poster boy, covers, lots of coverage in the magazines, you know, lived in California, was training partners with Rory, like you said. Mm-hmm. He's gotten all the exposure. Everybody knew him. I'd never even been in a picture.
Right.
Never been on a magazine, you know.
Right.
So that was intimidating, but they called me out and we compared, and they literally killed me posing, you know, comparisons over and over, to the point where at the end I couldn't even pull a lat spread. I just I was so exhausted I just couldn't do it. And they sent us off stage and I hit the panic button, and of course I freaked out thinking I lost because I couldn't pull that last comparison shot. So I run out into the audience, and at that time Wayne D'Amelio was there. And I knew him from New York because I was local. He was local. And I was like, that's it. I lost. I was freaking out. I lost. I blew it. I'm going to eat ice cream. And he sits me down. He's like, John, don't do anything stupid. Don't go eat ice cream. Just relax. And I just continued to bug. I'm like, no, I'm going to eat ice cream. And he begged me, literally talked me in off the ledge for like a half hour, trying to calm me down to not do it. And you know, the end result was that I won.
Yeah. I'm looking at the list of competitors from that show. Araneta was second. Labrada was fifth. Paul Jean-Guillaume, who had a great physique, he was sixth. Mike Ashley was ninth. Victor Terra, who was a great bodybuilder, he was 10th. And Richard Baldwin was 11th. And Daryl Stafford, who became a big force on the national scene later on, he was 14th. So you beat a lot of really great bodybuilders.
Yeah, I sure did. That was a big class and a big show, man.
And credit to the judging panel, because you were an unknown and you still beat Araneta, who was so well known.
Yep, absolutely. That's why I was so shocked, you know, because I figured, you know, everybody knew who he was, and he did have a fabulous physique.
Oh yeah, for sure. Great physique.
Well, you know, for whatever reason that day, they liked mine better. So,
what'd you think about Gaspari and Christian, the two other class winners? Because Gaspari won the light heavyweights and Christian won the heavyweights.
I mean, you know, I really didn't know those guys. It was kind of like, you know, your headspace is kind of like you're all over the place at that point. I mean, I watched. I know Rich at the Universe. I don't know what happened at the Nationals, but I know at the Universe he was really pushed by that guy Gromulus.
Oh yeah, he was a monster.
I think, you know, and I don't want to demean anybody's victories, but I vaguely remember like Richie kind of backed in the door with his win. I guess the judges were split, and when they totaled up the scores, he came out on top, but it was really, really close. And I think I was fairly close with Christian and DeMay at that time.
Or
I think that's who was in the show, Barry DeMay.
Yeah, I think Barry DeMay was second. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was real close between those two guys.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I think Rich won it in the pose down. I think you're right. He won at the very end.
I, I think he pulled it off. Yeah, and ironically, that year was the last year that there was a team trophy.
Oh, really? And, okay.
We had also won the team first place too.
So. Yeah, because you had three out of four then, classes. Yeah.
Well, that's not how it was done. It was done with you had to do a presentation, a routine. The four
guys. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was pretty cool too. So we won I got a medal for that too.
Yeah. Yeah. That was cool. Yeah. So what was your life like after that, John? You said Weider sent you out to California and did photo shoots. So how were you feeling?
Yeah. It all happened so fast that it was just, it didn't really sink in. Like I didn't truly know what was going on. We didn't have cell phones, obviously. We had to do everything through the mail, but my post office box was blowing up with mail from all over the world, mm-hmm. invitations to guest pose and just all kinds of craziness happened. I'd find myself, guest posing at shows and mm-hmm. traveling the world. And I basically at that point, I was 28. So I was like still a kid, like I said, it happened so fast that it was just something I did as a hobby and it turned out to what it was.
Yeah.
I'd find myself away for weeks at a time in strange lands and mm-hmm. I was married at the time. It was crazy. I'd bring home lots of cash, throw it on the table and 2 days later I'd be out the door again,
So yeah.
it was fast, man. It was crazy.
Were you still working as a cop in New Jersey?
I was, but what I did was because I had gotten so busy that the chief, of course, it brought a lot of notoriety to the department. Mm-hmm. So I asked him if I could take a leave of absence, and they granted me a leave of absence. And, they said, listen, if and when you ever want to come back, doors open,
Oh, that was cool.
So that's what I did. Yeah, I did. I took a 2-year leave of absence and pretty much traveled the world and did my thing and continued to train and then competed as a pro for a while. And then after that, because I had back in the day, you couldn't really make a living, so to speak, through bodybuilding. We didn't have the opportunities that these guys and girls have nowadays so much. Mm-hmm. So I knew I needed to have a real life and I did eventually go back to the PD.
Okay.
Which obviously paid my bills and
yeah,
health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Right. Right. So when you won that Mr. Universe after that, cause it was kind of sudden and it was sort of unexpected, that you went up so fast. Did you have any plans then? Were you going to compete as a pro? Did you want to win Mr. Olympia? What were your goals after that?
Well, sure. I wanted to compete as a pro and I did. But it took me, so that was 84 and my first show was 87.
Yeah.
Because I took some time off and then I had a pretty bad car accident in the winter, in 85 in New Jersey. I was on the turnpike actually, going to the gym and, it was a snowstorm and, mm-hmm. my car spun out and I got hit by three cars.
Wow.
So I walked away, but a few days later, my lower back, my lumbar had protruded a disc.
Mm.
So I was out of commission for almost a year. I literally couldn't walk. I mean, I was crawling around
the
floor.
Wow.
So all of those things that came so suddenly kind of almost went away equally as quick, and sort of did temporarily. So, that kind of put a kink in everything, in the plans. And it was a rude awakening. And that's really what made me realize that, hey, this can go away anytime.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much why I went back to the PD because, that could have happened. It could have been worse and I could have never been able to train again. So I was at that time, I was smart enough to realize that, hey, I need to have some security.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I went back to the police departments.
Yeah. Okay. I do remember now vaguely that you got in that car accident because I was looking at your contest history and I'm wondering why there was such a long break from the universe to when you did your first pro show.
Yep. Yep. And that was the reason.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, I wanted to try to get between being busy traveling. I wanted to try to get bigger,
mm-hmm.
Which you know, I got up to stage weight at a couple of shows, like low 200s, but that's as big as I could get at the time. Without being, you know, without being out of shape or considered out of shape. So, you know, standing next to a guy that weighs 245 when you're 200 pounds.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
You know, I realized also, like, I can't get to the point where these guys are.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of started to think about, you know, I did well. I'm not going to make a living doing this. I'm not going to kill myself trying. So I kind of put it all in perspective, luckily, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much how it played out.
What was your first pro show then, John? Was that that Night of the Champions in New York?
It was. It was Night of Champions, and I was third.
Yeah.
Beat a lot of good guys there, too. Yeah,
yeah, and that was a stacked show. Yeah, you beat Robbie Robinson.
Beat Robbie, beat Albert Beckles, beat Charles Glass, Bob Paris.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, a slew of guys, man, back in the day.
Yeah, that was a huge show back in the 80s and 90s, but that was a big pro debut, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. And, of course, it was in my backyard, being in New York.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, they put me on the poster, and I had a lot of support and a lot of fans, so it was cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, Gary Stridham won that, right, with Mike Ashley second.
Yeah, Mike Ashley was second, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then you did your first Olympia, right, after that?
I did my first Olympia in Sweden, I believe it was.
Yeah, Sweden.
And I was 10th, and I was devastated.
Yeah.
You know? Because I really thought I was going to do well. And, you know, your head is like, you haven't really lost. You've done well. And then I guess, the whole craziness of the Olympia and the travel catch up with you and the pressure. And I basically smoothed out. I didn't look great. I looked okay.
Mm-hmm.
But coming in 10th and, you know, it added to that wake-up call deal where I'm like, I'm not going to be able to sustain, you know, a lifestyle or a normal life without having a structured, you know, career, income,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. So,
yeah.
You know, all of those things contributed to me staying in law enforcement. Thankfully.
Okay.
Because now I have a pension. I'll have that until... Till I die, basically. So
yeah. That Olympia was on TV, and I think Chris Dickerson was the commentator, and he mentioned you. I mean, he pointed, you know, he singled you out, and he said he thought you should have placed higher, because I remember when they started the pose down, the CBS commentator asked Chris Dickerson, who would you have had in this top six that isn't in here? And he said John Natashek. So I thought that was pretty cool. So he must have thought you deserved to be up there.
You know, Chris interviewed me at the Universe. He was a huge, I guess you could say, fan or supporter. You know, he always loved my physique and always mm-hmm. complimented me, which was, you know, this is coming from a tremendous bodybuilder back in the day. So
yeah.
You know, that was very encouraging, actually,
mm-hmm.
to hear those things from him.
And Chris was a fan of guys who had a balanced physique, so he must have looked at you and saw that, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what he basically used to say to me, you know, off camera and off mic. He would always tell me how you know, symmetrical and balanced and what a great physique I had. So, yeah, that was very encouraging and very flattering.
You know? Yeah. And then there was another show that year in Germany that Ron Love won, the World Championships, World Pro Championships. You were in that also too, right, John? You got fifth?
Yeah, I believe I was fifth in that show.
Yeah.
And that was like basically the first time we did a competitive tour.
Okay.
So no one really knew what to do. Everybody was kind of... It was sort of helter-skelter because no one had ever done that before. And we were on the road, I believe, for 2 weeks. I think it might have been more. And we did like a handful of shows in that two-week period. And so, you know, your body, I mean, if you don't know how to, you know, how to do proper nutrition, et cetera, you really don't know. So you learn as you go. And there were some mistakes made, et cetera. But, you know, nowadays, these guys do it all day long, right?
Yeah.
it was difficult. It was a new challenge and kind of an unknown.
Yeah. So how did you do it, John? Just try to get your workouts in wherever you were at and just try to eat whatever food they had available?
You tried to eat the best you could and do the best you could as far as gym workouts. But, I mean, you know, you're in a show. You're prepped for a show. You know, you're tanning on a plane. You're tanning in the aisles, you know, along
really?
With 20 other guys.
Wow, that's crazy.
You know, yeah, it was – and then so you fly, you know, you're flying all hours and then get to a location or a venue and do it again. You know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't established. It wasn't I guess they, you know, the promoters, et cetera, were learning also, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because everybody was kind of just winging it, you know.
Yeah, it was all new, yeah.
Yep. So it was interesting for, at the very least, it was interesting, you know.
Yeah. So when you were in at Olympia, what did you think of those top guys? Like, that was probably the first time you got to see Haney up close, first time you got to compete with him, and Rich Gaspari was second, and Labrada was up there, and Mike Christian again. What did you think of those top?
I was completely intimidated, totally and completely intimidated.
Yeah.
You know, as a matter of fact, in one of the lineups, I was standing next to Haney.
Oh, really?
Stage, uh-huh. And I remember standing next to him and just, like, looking at him. He was to my left. And I was on stage looking at his physique. I'm like, what am I doing here? Like, standing next to this monster, right. You know. It was intimidating. It really, truly was. Like, I didn't even, you know, I wasn't one of these guys that had mega self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still sort of, it was so, so new to me. And it
yeah.
happened
yeah.
so quickly that I was, like, in disbelief. Like, you know, it was surreal. It really was.
Yeah.
Back in the day, those guys were, you know, were monsters.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't, you know, so.
Yeah.
I was intimidated for sure.
Yeah, people forget how great Haney was back then, you know. I mean, those who never saw him in his prime, they forget how good he was.
Well, you know, nowadays, if you're not current on social media, these kids don't know who we are, who we
mm-hmm.
were.
Right.
They don't know who Lou Haney is, you know. They have no
right.
clue.
Right.
I mean,
that's,
they don't know who
shame.
Won last year. You know?
I know.
It's unbelievable because if your face isn't on social media, you know, promoting videos or promoting your training or doing, you know, sneak peeks or this or that, they don't know
mm-hmm.
who you are. And there's so many people competing nowadays that, you know, you get lost in the mix.
Yeah, yeah. So then the next year in 88, you went to Chicago and you did the Chicago Pro Championships, which Phil Williams won, and he beat out Gary Stridham, and you were right behind those guys. You were in third place.
Yeah, I was in third place. And again, ironically, in that show, because of my car accident, when I dieted down and became extremely tight, I guess lack of lubrication in my lower back locked up. I was in bad, bad shape. I didn't think I was going to make the show.
Oh, really?
And yeah, it was really bad. Like, I couldn't move. I couldn't pose. And there was a dude, I believe he was from Trinidad, big, big guy. His name was Bill Richardson.
Oh, yeah. I remember him.
And that guy, he had these hands that were size of cars. I mean, he was a big dude, and he saw how much pain and suffering I was in. And he actually massaged my lower back,
mm-hmm.
spasms. And he worked on my lower back probably for the better part of an hour.
Wow.
And if he had not done that, there's no way I would have been able to step on that stage. But because of him, I was able to compete.
Holy yeah. cow.
Yep.
So that was when you got to the show, your back was locking up when you got to the show.
Yep. It went out like the night before.
Mm. Wow.
And you know, I don't know if stress contributed to that.
The travel.
I believe it
yeah.
was more lack of water and lubrication, you know,
mm-hmm.
Depletion, et cetera. And that, I think, was what caused it. Because I didn't do anything. It just went out overnight.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Things,
yeah. Yeah, I've had that happen when your back goes out. That's the worst kind of pain.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Because you can't do anything. You can't pose.
No,
you can't
even stand up. Yeah.
you can't arch your back to, you know, do a lat spread from the rear.
It was tough. What'd you think of Phil Williams and Gary that night? Because they were both in top shape too.
You know, Phil Williams had a really, you know, Phil had a very balanced, pretty physique. He wasn't big, he wasn't massive, but he had a really balanced, symmetrical, proportioned physique.
Mm-hmm.
Where Gary was a mass monster, and, you know, I talk to Gary periodically. He's in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
But for lack of better description, he was not the best poser and didn't present himself very well.
Yeah, that's true.
And he was big at that show, but he was off.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was on the smooth side, what we used to say smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why he lost.
Yeah.
But Phil was on, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was at that show because I was from Chicago, so I remember going to that show, and I thought Phil won it. You know, I thought it was the right decision, you know, because he, especially his back, was so incredible, and that's where Gary was weak.
Yeah, he was. Phil was good, man. Phil was good. I mean, he didn't stick around long.
No.
But he was good in the day, for sure.
Now, were you qualified for the Olympia that year, John? Or because I noticed you didn't do the Olympia in '88.
I was in California for the Olympia, and I had gotten sick as a dog. I was in Santa Monica, did a ton of photo shoots, and I got deathly ill, and I couldn't make it on stage.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't make it on stage, and I was probably in the best shape of my life.
Wow, really? Oh, man.
Yeah, I think I would have done, I would have definitely easily been top 10. You know, and I don't want to say and sound, you know, cocky or whatever, but quite possibly would have been 5 or 6, you know. So, yeah, it was a disappointment. It was a disappointment.
What happened? You got the flu or something?
I actually got some sort of an infection. And they didn't really, at that point, didn't know what it was from or how I got it.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like I got hit with a bat. I mean, I couldn't even move. It was,
it was
actually scary. You know, they loaded me up with antibiotics, but I couldn't eat. I couldn't hold any food down. So, yeah, there was no way I was going to walk out on stage green, you know?
Yeah. How far out from the show was that?
It was like, the show was Saturday. I think it was like midweek, Wednesday.
Oh, God. I
was in the Santa Monica Hotel.
Yeah.
I was out there for a week or two prior, you know, getting ready. It might have been because I was worn out too from doing the photo shoots and the diet and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, back then when you did a photo shoot, you know, depending on who you did it with, it was like an 8-hour ordeal.
Right.
So, you know, it was brutal.
They
wanted real weight. They wanted, you know, you actually did basically, depending on how many body parts you photographed that day, it was a real workout. So you did almost a full body workout, balls to the wall.
Right.
It was tough.
Yeah. Right.
You know, you can't say no right back then.
Right.
You can't say no to a photo shoot. So
that's
probably what did me in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may have even been, a bad meal or something. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next year you did the Grand Prix USA Pro. Where was that at? Nimrod King was the winner and Benny Comerford was second. You got, you were fifth in that one?
I was fifth, yeah. That show, I don't, you know, I think it's just those guys were bigger and better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, I remember not feeling, again, not feeling I was at my best. So I was like trying to hide behind the other lineup.
Oh, yeah.
behind the other guys because I was embarrassed. And they kept calling me out, you know, not in top five.
Right.
But I moved up, and I guess I looked better than I thought. I always had a confidence issue, you know?
Yeah.
I guess I was a little bit better than I gave myself credit for.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if my confidence level was a little different, who knows? Maybe I would have done better.
Right.
But I guess I'll never know, right?
Great. And you did the Night of the Champions that year, too, right?
Yeah, I did Night of Champions. I don't remember where I was in that second Night of Champions. I think I was top five.
It said 11th here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See,
Vince Taylor won that year, remember? And Nimrod King was second.
Yeah, I can't remember that show. It's all a blur.
Yeah, yeah. So were you thinking about quitting then around that time, John, around 89?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what happened. I was like, you know, I was at that point in my, you know, in my career where I was like, you know, I've been doing this a couple of years now and beating myself mm-hmm. up and mm-hmm. I'll always train, but I'll never win. You know, I'm not big enough. I'm not good enough. So, and I had gone back to work at that point too. So I was working a full-time job.
Yeah.
And training, preparing for a show, which is very difficult undertaking.
Yeah.
So I think it took its toll. Plus I was married, you know, I had a house and,
yeah,
you know, I had a life outside of bodybuilding, competing bodybuilding. I know I'll always work out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was done with competing at that point, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it showed in my placings, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you did come back. You did the Masters, right, in 2001, 2002, when they had that Olympia Masters.
That was 12 years later.
Yeah.
Yep. And I did that, and it was a fluke. And here's the story behind that. When I was – boy, I'm really dating myself. When I was a kid
mm-hmm.
In grammar school, they were talking about write an essay about what it's going to be like in 2001.
Oh, yeah.
And okay. I was like, man, 2001, you know, I was like, what, 7, 8 years old? And I was like, I'll be 43 years old.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, I never forgot that. And 2001 came around, and prior to that, I'm like, hey, I'm 43. It's 2001. I've been in the gym. I just haven't been active, you know, mm-hmm. competitive. And, I did it for shits and giggles, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wound up placing third. And I should have done better, actually.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
And that was, you know, Don Youngblood and Vince Taylor.
Right, right. You were right behind
Don
that.
Don Youngblood, rest his soul, you know. And, yeah, I was third, and I really thought I should have been second. But whatever, you know.
Yeah. Always,
you know, you're in that mindset. You think you should do better sometimes, but – for me to say I should have done better, I probably should have.
Yeah, yeah.
But that being said, I wound up where I wound up, and it was fun. It was cool.
How was it training and dieting again after that long of a layoff?
Well, I'd never really laid off the gym. I'd always been in the gym.
Okay.
And I never got fat. I never get, you know, totally out of shape. Obviously, mm-hmm. I'm not in contest shape.
Mm-hmm.
But I never quit the gym. I just quit competing.
Okay.
So the difference was obviously eating diet was so different. Training was so different. You know, my body was mature at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I competed. I think I was on stage at like the high 90s.
Okay.
Which was the biggest I'd ever been. But I was pretty shredded for that show and pretty full and round.
Yeah. Me. Yeah.
And still, of course, retained, you know, my, you know, proportions, my symmetry. So that was a fun show, you know, it really was. It was cool to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, you know, at that point in my life, I wasn't like younger years. Oh, my God, I got to do good because if I don't, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to make money, blah, 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 blah. At that point, this was all for fun. And I didn't care. I had no pressure. I just competed to compete.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was actually fun as compared to what I just described, you know, oh man, I got to do good. If I don't do good, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that.
Right.
So, it was much easier, much more fun. And it was a lot more rewarding, you know, to do well and still have, you know, a career and a family to go back to.
Where was that contest held, John? Do you remember?
That was in Lynchburg, Virginia.
Oh, okay. When Jan Tanna was playing it out, right?
Jan Tanna promoted that show, yeah.
Right, right. Okay. And then you came back and did it again the next year, right?
I did it again, and that was my last show.
Yeah.
I did it again, yeah. And I was somehow it said I was tied for fifth with mm-hmm. Chris Duffy.
Yep.
And then when you look at the placings, they said I was sixth, but from what I was told and from what I remember, I was actually fifth. So I don't know if they got it wrong, right, or whatever. Not
right.
that it matters, 5, 6, right, at that point.
Right, right.
But, yeah, that was the last hurrah. And then mm-hmm. you know, from that point, I became active, very active judging.
Yeah.
And that's where I remain.
Okay. And when did you move to Florida, John, from New Jersey?
I moved here in June or July of 2012.
Okay.
I had just had it with the winters. Mm-hmm. The cold. I was retired from the police department, and I had a pension, and I had, you know, other incomes. I had a couple of businesses, and you know, my ex-wife, now my ex-wife, my wife at the time, was also sick and tired of the cold and the, you know, the traffic and the expense of living in North Jersey. So we just decided that Florida was the place, and she transferred, you know, she worked for a big corporation, and we came down here and settled in.
Okay.
Actually, ironically, I just closed on a house on the 2nd last week.
Oh, congratulations. Where's that?
In Delray Beach. And I'm very excited.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Nice.
So currently I'm in Central Florida, but I'll be in South Florida within a few weeks permanently.
Okay. What's Delray Beach next to? What's that by?
It's about a half hour north of Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
Right next door borders Boca.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real nice beach town. You know, the ocean is, my house is 3.5 miles from the beach. You know, it's what my picture of Florida is: palm trees, beach, ocean.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a cool town, man. And I'm excited, looking forward to it.
Oh, that's great. And what's your training like now, John? How do you train it now?
You know, I train one body part a day.
Okay.
But I do probably, depending on the body part, like for chest, I'll probably do a minimum of like 16, 17 sets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even touch heavy weight, but I guess some people would consider it fairly heavy, but for me, I go moderate weight, high reps. You know, I feel the motion complete start to finish, you know, eccentric, concentric. I don't try to pound heavy weights. I don't push to where my eyeballs are popping out of my head. I'm consistent, you know. I go five, usually 6 days a week, unless I'm on the road, you know, the weekend. And I do, again, one body part a day, and I do high reps and high sets, except for arms. I'll do maybe 9, 10 tops, 12 sets, depending on how I feel that day. And I separate body parts, you know, and so it has 6 days, body part has 6 days basically of rest. And at my age, you know, I'm 62. At this age, I get compliments all the time on how I look. You know, I try to take care of myself, but I enjoy training now. It's not a job. It's really my social time. You know?
Yeah.
The gym is my happy place, you know.
Right. Right.
It's where I go, and it's my social time. And, you know, I have lots of friends there. And I still put in the work. Don't get me wrong. I still train. But But it's fun training. It's not like uber serious, like don't talk to me, you know.
Right.
So I enjoy being in the gym. I'll be in the gym, you know, in theory, hopefully, till the day I die. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I'm still involved, obviously, on the judging side of it. You know, I do lots of pro shows with the pro league, pro league, and I do, you know, a fair amount of regional shows. I head judge in Florida, you know, a good amount of shows.
Mm-hmm.
I do some national shows, so it keeps me involved. It keeps me in touch. It keeps me motivated. And I'm, you know, aside from being a judge, I'm a fan. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I understand and respect what it takes to step on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know what these folks go through. Although I'm going to say this, I think it's easier nowadays, not easier being getting in shape, but the diets are so much different. There's so much more variety of food. Like back in the day, I couldn't touch a piece of red meat. Oh my God. Can't have red meat. It's fat. It got fat in it. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's evolved so much. And I understand that. So it's kind of cool, you know, to see it change the way it has and become so much more popular. I mean, back in the day when I walked on the beach down, you know, South Jersey, you could walk for 3 miles and maybe see one other guy that lifted weights, right?
Yeah, right.
Now you can't walk 3 blocks without seeing 50 people that are in shape or that train.
Yeah, that's amazing. So yeah,
everybody's in the gym, you know.
Right, so, that's true. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, it's cool.
I want to ask you a question. We just did an interview on my podcast a couple of weeks ago with Lonnie Tieper and Peter McGuff, and the main topic of conversation was where they thought the future of the look of bodybuilding is going. And the reason I brought this up to these guys is because we had Sean Roden win the Mr. Olympia last year, and he had that really streamlined waist, good abs. And they said that Phil Heath probably lost because the stomach was sticking out for a couple of years in a row now. And then we just had Brandon Curry win the Arnold Classic, and he's another guy that's got the smaller waist, the V-taper. So my question to Lonnie and Peter was, do you think we could go back to – and you're a bodybuilder from the 80s. You started off in the 80s, so you know what it's like to have a symmetrical physique and how the physiques were judged back then, which is much different than the way they are today because the guys were much smaller. But if you look at some of those pro shows from the 70s and 80s, like – of course, Frank Zane won the Mr. Olympia 3 times, and he beat a lot of bigger guys. And the reason was because he had this great symmetry. And then you had Bob Paris win the Nationals. You had Samir Benoot win the Mr. Olympia over bigger guys. You had Muhammad McAway winning pro shows over guys like Lee Haney and Bertel Fox. So my question to Peter and Lonnie was, do you think we could go back to that now that the guys have been so big for the last 30 years? Do you think we could go back to where the judges start rewarding guys who have more symmetry? And Lonnie was saying he thinks once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't go back. I mean, once we've seen these guys being this big for like the last 30 years, as we've seen, starting with probably Dorian, we can't go backwards now. We can't have a smaller guy beat a bigger guy. So what's your feelings on that, Judd? Because I know you're a judge and you also competed back in the 80s. So do you think we could start rewarding guys that are smaller and more symmetrical, or do you think that's why they had to create other divisions like classic physique for that?
Well, okay. As far as classic physique, I love classic physique. I think it's an awesome, attainable, beautiful class look, appearance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That being said, as far as the open, these massive, massive guys tend to not be pretty,
mm-hmm.
As you just said. I think given, if you take a guy like Brandon, and I'm going to use those guys because they've just currently, you know, in the forefront winning. If you take those guys and you take away that ultra mass, okay, they're still, don't get me wrong, maybe Sean standing next to a guy like,
big Romney, mm-hmm.
he's not big. However, I wouldn't categorize him as small.
Small, right.
Okay, and when you compare them body part per body part, in poses, comparisons,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't take it away from Roden. He beats those big guys as far as aesthetics. Maybe in certain shots, he may appear smaller, okay? But I don't think the clock will be turned back.
Right.
However, if those types of physiques are in super condition, and I'm not – so Brandon Curry is not small by any means. He's a big dude. However, like you said, he's got a tiny waist. He looks incredible standing there. He doesn't have the gut. His belly is flat. He controls his stomach. And I think it's a matter of the amounts of food that these guys ingest. It's hard to control their stomachs. You know, and there's all kinds of theories on what's going on with that. But I think, I mean, these guys eat 2 pounds of meat in one sitting for dinner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a lot of substance to put in a small area such as your stomach. So I don't know that it's ever going to go back to a Frank Zane winning the Olympia or that type of appearance. Because that, let's be honest, that's small, right?
Yeah.
But if you take Frank Zane and fast forward 30 years later to now and put 25 pounds on him, but he but he retains that look, he's got a good shot at winning the Olympia.
Okay. So a guy who is smaller than the lineup, as long as he's has enough muscle mass, but he's still got that symmetry, he could still potentially win.
I really, truly believe that. And I and listen, last year was the proof in the pudding. You know,
like Sean Roden. Yeah.
Absolutely. He was he had a beautiful physique. He had beautiful balance and proportions. He presents himself so aesthetically, you know.
Yeah.
There's no grimacing. He smiles at every pose. He just looks comfortable. Whereas, you know, some of the other guys, you know, they struggle. They struggle breathing because they're so massive. And I'm not taking anything away from those guys. They're incredibly impressive.
Oh yeah.
But I think you're going to have your fair share of both types of physiques on any given day. The smaller, more conditioned, but he can't be like flat and small. They'd have to be round and full and still give the illusion of being large, but in shredded condition with the small waist, the large V taper, you know, flaring, full quads, deep separation. You know, I think depending on the lineup, those guys can still hold their own today in this day and age.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to take a guy like Rolly and not place him higher because he's so big. But if he comes in shape, of course, if he comes in great shape, separated, balanced, and you put him next to a littler guy, Rolly's going to win. But if Rolly's just, and I'm not singling anybody out, I'm just using him as an example, so Rolly, don't get pissed off at me. You know, if he's just massively large, I don't think he's going to beat a guy that's in condition that's not quite as big, but say he's 10 pounds lighter, but the illusion is that he's not 10 pounds lighter so much. That guy's got a good shot at doing better.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, we saw that at the Arnold where Rolly was out of shape.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know what? I mean, it's even though it's a different day and age and the mass monsters were killing it, year, 2, 3 years ago, it's, you know, I think it's cyclical. And I think hard work, balance, proportion, symmetry, condition is going to start to be rewarded more so.
Yeah. What do you think when the average bodybuilding fan, and maybe this isn't even a person that would go to the shows, but they look at guys like Frank Zane or Serge Nobre or maybe Samir, and they go, man, that's when bodybuilding was really good. You know, they think that the guys now are just so big that it's not attainable. Like you said, you just use that word attainable. And I guess maybe they can't relate to it. And they just think that was more of an art form and those guys look better compared to the guys today.
You know, I agree. I don't listen. Genetically, there's only a handful of guys that can attain that mass and size. Right.
Right.
However, classic men's physique is so much more attainable for the average guy on the street, and it's much more likable. So in my opinion, as a fan, am I impressed by those guys that are huge? Sure. It's impressive to see, oh my God, look at the size of this guy on stage. I think it's somewhat of a different ball game. When you start comparing apples to oranges,
yeah.
Thing classic I think obviously Classic is on the rise. I mean, there's so many more competitors in Classic. Because it's such, you know, again, it's a much more aesthetic, attainable look.
Yeah.
And it's pleasing. I mean, you know, it's pleasing to the eye. Now, okay, let's say you have an auditorium full of 1,000 people, bodybuilding fans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not demeaning the fans. I love the fans. They're not judges.
Right.
You know, so they're impressed by the mass, the size. And I get it. I get it 100%. But just being bigger doesn't necessarily mean better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a sign of a good judge, right? Someone who can break apart a physique and look at the symmetry and look at the proportions and look at the size.
My humble opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
you know, I'm not speaking for, I can only speak for myself,
mm-hmm.
but I, you know, again, I think the Olympia was the proof in the pudding. You know?
Yeah. You know, what was interesting to me too, John, was at that Arnold Classic recently, they had that seminar on Sunday and they brought up Ronnie Coleman and Jay Cutler and Phil Heath and a lot of the other former champions. But when Ronnie came up and Bob Ciccarillo was interviewing him, he said, "Hey, Ronnie, if we could take all 8 of your Mr. Olympia wins from 1998 to 2005 and put them up on the stage here, which guy was the best?" And immediately he said the first one, 1998, when he weighed like 247 pounds. So even though he got up to almost 300 pounds on stage, he thought his best look was 247 pounds. Now, here's a guy who is definitely one of the mass monsters, him like Dorian. I mean, he's one of the biggest dudes ever, probably the biggest Mr. Olympia will ever have. And he said his best look was when he was lighter. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, he was very critical of himself also. And when he first started out, he kind of, through, you know, what I've seen and in speaking to him, he was not also an over-the-top, cocky, confident dude,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that first win for him and that look was obviously, you know, he said it. I thought that was his best look.
Mm-hmm.
Was he impressive years later? Oh, my God, huge. Absolutely. Did he get out of shape? Yeah, maybe a couple of times. But for the most part, even as big as he was in condition.
Yeah.
And he was in shape. You know, he was never out of shape.
Yeah, that's what Ciccarillo was kind of surprised. He goes, "No, not 2003 when he shocked everybody and he was like 287, you know, and he said, that wasn't your best." And he goes, "No." He said, "The first one."
Yeah, yeah. I you know, I tend to believe that. I tend to agree.
Yeah, bigger, I think, isn't always better. And I remember like what guys like Lee Labrada used to say, and Bob Paris was famous for saying this. He said, your structure can only hold so much size. And once you go beyond that, it ruins the lines. It ruins the flow. It ruins the look of the physique.
Absolutely. It starts to distort.
Yeah.
You know, not only are...
Even though they might be shredded and ripped, it's just too much muscle for their frame.
It's a distorted look.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, you know, your shoulders are going to get bigger. Your arms are going to get bigger. Your back's going to get bigger. But inevitably... Everything else is going to get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Internally, your organs are going to get bigger. So, you know, turning to the side, you have this massive thickness, you know, the distorted look. It's just, it's not necessarily pleasant. But
mm-hmm.
I think that's slowly changing. I really do.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever going to be... Again, I don't think a guy that's 180 pounds is ever going to win the Olympia. I just don't
right.
think that's realistic.
You can't go back 40 years. Yeah, it's too far.
But I, you know, let's be, I mean, Phil Heath, you know, phenomenal bodybuilder. Wasn't always the biggest guy on the stage.
Right.
240.
Right.
When he was right, the guy was unbeatable.
Yeah, that's true.
And he wasn't one of these massive, massive guys, but he was just pretty. His physique
mm-hmm.
was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he'll, I think he's got a shot at coming back and getting it right. I really do. You know, he had some, I guess he had the hernia issue that I'm under the impression that he's had repaired. So, you know, time will tell. September, we'll know.
Yeah, that'll be exciting if he does come back.
It will be, yeah.
So, all right, John. Well, thanks for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I've been hoping to have you on here for a while now because I know we're both Floridians. So I'm glad we finally got a chance to talk to you. And congratulations on a great career, and congratulations on your new home in Florida. And I'm sure I'll be seeing you around at some of the shows.
You will.
I'll see you probably at the Olympia for sure, if not anything else.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for the interview. Thanks.
All right, John. Thanks, buddy. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs, for their sponsorship of this episode. I also want to thank our Patreon donors, James Kerr, Mark Johnson, and Scott Barron, who continue to help support the show every month with their monthly donations. I really appreciate you guys. You really help the show keep going. If you want to be a Patreon sponsor of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, then just go to my website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, we have a Patreon link, and you can just click on that. We have different levels. You can donate as much as you want or as little as you want. I just appreciate anybody helping to sponsor the show. We do have costs associated, so I do appreciate your support, guys. And thank you again, James, Mark, and Scott, for continuing to support the Bodybuilding Legend podcast. All right, without further ado, here is our article of the week. The name of the article was called Cutting Some Fancy Figures, and it appeared in the July 10th, 1972 issue of Sports Illustrated. I think this is Mario's note here. It says, the following is the first bodybuilding article ever featured in Sports Illustrated. Okay, it reads, they chose the best body on the East Coast at a strutter's ball. Outside the auditorium, or pavilion as it's called, it is a gorgeous Sunday afternoon at the Mountain Park Amusement Center in Holyoke, Massachusetts. A roller coaster clatters up and down a wooden trestle. Children fly around in little whirly things that look like boats with wings. There are clam bars, pizza stands, dart throws, cotton candy boots, a commando machine gun stall. The sky is raucous blue. The sun is hot and a lot of people are laughing. Outside Mountain Park, on all sides, stretches Holyoke suburbia. Big homes and fine lawns that make the place feel mischievous and isolated. An island of gaudery in the midst of all that yawning green. Especially today. Today in the pavilion, a body contest is going on. A festival of flesh. Maybe the gaudiest of all sporting events and strange as a llama race to the average suburban fan. Leon Brown, who works in a laundry in New York, is in there posing for the 1972 Mr. East Coast title. Following the din that greeted his high-chested glide on stage, there is a total hush over the 1,200 assembled. He stands in the center of the stage, illuminated by a single spot, alone atop the leopard skin posing dais. He shifts. He fixes his eyes somewhere at the back of the huge auditorium and slides into his first pose to a pandemonium of shrieks and applause. Brown's mouth stays a little ajar. His eyes are flat, concentrating. He looks like somebody might be teaching him canasta. He shows the judges his breathtakingly graceful legs. You could lose a dime in the separations between the almond-shaped muscles of each frontal thigh. The gastrocnemius muscles of the calves bulge like upside-down hearts. Then he pivots on one foot like a dancer, jiggles the muscles tense, and finds a back pose. It's dynamite. Trapezius, deltoid, infraspinatus, the flaring latissimus dorsi. All the workhouse muscles of the back gleam like oiled chocolate in delineated, organized mounds above his glare-blue posing trunks. The response from the crowd is mighty near hysterical. Brown holds the pose and holds it. It is one of his best, and he holds it until the muscles begin to quiver from the strain. Then he flows down the line of the pose into a side shot, left wrist clutched by the right hand behind his back, pectoral muscles of the chest round and dense as grapefruit at the top of a long concave curve of his rib cage. He turns his stiffened, flexed left arm in front of the judges, laying all three heads of his tricep brachii on them. It's too much. The shouts thicken into moans. Oh, my God, says a man near the front. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Brown has them pinned, and he knows it. Watching him finish his routine is akin to watching a hawk plunder a rabbit in an open field. A clean swooping. There's no necessity for fancy moves. Bodybuilding as a competitive sport never has had the national sanction or interest that its participants think it deserves. To most Americans, it just seems so weird. All those huge people who seem to resemble ordinary men the way a tattoo does a birthmark, posing and flexing up in those little skimpy shorts. Unflattering myths develop. They are all muscle-bound, coordinated, helpless lumps. Bodybuilders who are good at other sports are really the rule rather than the exception. That they will slide into fat the moment they stop all that unnatural exercise, only if they keep on eating as much. And that they are all homosexual anyway. You try telling them that one. And our collective imagination pictures dark, fleshy exhibitions and seedy Ys and high school gyms full of wine-drunk voyeurs. It isn't really like that, but bodybuilding itself hasn't done much to clarify the image. For years, the sport has been too vexed and mired by internecine skirmishes between its two competition sponsoring organizations, the AAU and the International Federation of Bodybuilders, to worry about many of its larger problems. Ed Jubenville is the promoter and MC of the Mr. East Coast Contest, an IFBB event. He has also held the title of World's Greatest Muscle Control Artist for 25 years. He can make his muscles dance like no other man in the sport. Jubenville has put on 43 contests at Mountain Park. The Mr. East Coast is not one of the most important annual events, not in the same league, say, with the Universe or America or World, but it is always a classy competition and some big dudes are on hand. Mike Katz, the 1970 IFBB Mr. America, Mr. Northeast, Mr. International, etc., who ranks among the top four or five bodybuilders in the country, World, Universe right now, won it 2 years ago. He's a judge this time. Gordon Babb, best back at the Mr. America, is in the audience, and so are Warren Fredericks, often called the human anatomy chart, and 1969 Mr. World Tony Carroll, who is giving out catalogs for his muscle hugger torso shirts. Before anything begins on stage at a body contest, the audience always knows who is there. You spot them as they walk in. Bodybuilders are often individualistic to the point of kinkiness, and they have a way of standing out. Mike Katz says they are the only athletes whose sport you can tell just by looking at them. It's not just their size that accounts for this, or even their fabulous proportions. Katz's chest is 58 inches, and his waist is 31, a difference of 27 inches as compared to the average of 7 or 8. His biceps is 21 inches around, about the size of a small woman's waist. It has more to do with an odd variety of self-consciousness, a highly developed aesthetic sense of self that comes from having more or less the same relationship to your own body that an artist does to his artwork. A bodybuilder's body is the product of what he does. And when he walks around, he is not just getting from one place to another, he is exhibiting the results of his labor. For Mike Katz to get those mind-boggling pectoral muscles that push his chest out so far he can balance a glass of water on it, he has pumped iron 4 hours a day for 10 years. So generally, he doesn't walk at all. He struts, putting it all out front, chest high, arms bowed slightly away from the body to show the spread of his laterals. It's a wonderful movement. It makes you realize that, as Kat says, most people walk around looking like pieces of junk. The Mountain Park Pavilion is about 150 feet long and shaped like a barn. Beams studded with light bulbs traverse the dome ceiling. The audience sits shoulder to beefy shoulder in rows of connected wooden chairs. They are animated, noisy, and big, these fans, maybe in the same vicarious way that a lot of hockey fans are mean. To the left of the stage is the warm-up room or pit where the builders prepare for the competition, anointing their shaved bodies with baby oil to bring out highlights under the spot and pumping up, blitzing the muscles with dumbbell and tension exercises that oxygenate and swell them and bring the veins closer to the skin. Veins are very important here. Behind the screen, the 22 builders getting in last-minute pull-ups, tricep presses, flies, and curls mutter and shuffle like cattle in a boxcar. They've been divided into three height classes, those under 5'7", those over 5'9", and those in between. There will be five trophies for each class, plus overall awards for best poser, most muscular, and, of course, Mr. East Coast. Ed Jubenville announces the shorts. They file on stage from the pit and stand facing the audience, arms bowed, chest out, under the full glare of the house lights. There are eight of them, ranging in size from Kennedy Gomez, a slender, wistfully smiling boy, to Buddy Landau, who is as heavily muscled as a water buffalo. But even the most untrained eye can pick out the class. It's the sixth man in line, Leon Brown. The others might as well date behind the screen. From their table at the foot of the stage, Katz and the other judges gaze up at the shorts. Officially, they are looking for three things: general appearance, symmetry, and muscularity. But what they actually appraise is how big the muscles are, how well proportioned, and how cleanly each muscle group is defined or cut from the ones around it. Jubenville has the shorts make four quarter turns to the right, pausing between each to give the judges a shot of both sides and the back. Then he stands them off and brings them back one at a time for a 2 to 3 minute individual posing routine under the spot. It is these routines that body contests are won or lost, and where the peculiar essence of the sport best manifests itself. Good posing is partly a technical matter of knowing how to exhibit your strong points and obscure any weak ones, but beyond that, it is an ability like diving or hitting a baseball that depends on intuitive resources of timing and coordination. If it is done as Leon Brown does it during the couple of minutes he occupies the dais, with perfect dignity and finish, there is nothing ridiculous or even remotely embarrassing about it. Suddenly, it is no longer a greased, nearly naked man you are watching, but a clean, hard geometry of circles and curves. Even Brown seems detached from what he is doing, looking down at his flexed biceps. His face shows no recognition of the flesh. He seems to be looking at just an arrangement of stresses. There is no competition for Brown in the mediums, a fact that disappoints the crowd. They cheer only perfunctorily. But three of the talls are huge, and as soon as the group comes out, the crowd senses there may be a real contest for Mr. East Coast after all. Bob Klez, Errol Catterow, and Ray Delaney each sport a lot of bulk. Klez lingers on the dais, taking his time over mostly chest and stomach poses. He is bearded and has tattooed dragons on each calf that wreathe whenever he flexes his legs. Catterow, who probably has the best back in the contest, keeps it up in front of the judges. His positions are long-lined and dramatic, and whenever he does turn around, he looks as if he's engaged in some kind of fierce prayer. It is Delaney who seems the greatest threat. He is massive. His skin is paler than anybody else's, and he has not mixed iodine in his baby oil to darken it. His body looks like a gigantic piece of carved candle wax, and the classic sculptural poses he puts it through are effective. But sometime during his routine, or maybe later in the pose-off he has with Klez for the first in their class, it becomes clear that Delaney, even with his beer keg chest and arms that look like they are slugged full of sausage, cannot do it. Nor Klez, nor Catterow. That all the bulk on the East Coast is not going to do it today against Leon Brown's fearful symmetry. For the 2 or 3 minutes while he was stretching out that back pose and turning that triceps in front of the judges, Brown had managed to do what bodybuilding is all about, to make a form of sport and a form of art merge momentarily in the sure exhibition of a body trained as far as the muscles will allow, pushed against the natural inertia of tissue into its final form. Before the first trophy is handed out, the crowd is shouting, "Leon, Leon." He swept it. He won Mr. East Coast, his class, most muscular, and best poser. With each new trophy, Leon made a little bow, expressionless still, and threw the ravening crowd a new pose. They did not stop yelling for a long time, those 1,200 big people, and the carnival atmosphere that body contests always create took a long time to blow off. A number of people even stayed in their chairs to wait for Brown, Klez, Delaney, and the others to leave after they'd showered. Eyes moving from left to right, they watched each of them strut out into the park in that odd, high-chested way. A lot of mouths were pursed, and it was easy to believe that some of those people might be wondering about the same urge that Caro Shapiro muses on in The Leg. The body, what is it, Father, but a sign to love the force that grows us, to give back what in thy palm is senselessness and mud. All right, that was it. Great, great article by Charles Gaines. Man, can that guy write or what? I never read that article before, so it was awesome to read that. Thank you to Pat Comer and Mario Strong for sending me that article. I appreciate it, guys. That was great. That was really bodybuilding history, and that's the way bodybuilding should be, right? The way Charles describes it, the combination of art and sport. Great, great stuff. All right, guys, that's it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode. Thanks to John Natashak for the interview. And next week, we will be joined by Jerry Scalise, one of the top East Coast bodybuilders, who was in the 1980s and early 1990s. And Jerry competed in the AAU and also NAVA and also the MPC. So we'll be talking to Jerry next week. Till then, take care, guys. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Take care.